Okay, we have, now we're going to have our main speaker here, and we have Alan Kemp here to introduce him. Would you introduce our great speaker, Alan?
I would. We're still searching. Today, our speaker is Heinz Wegener, president of Cross Technologies and former chairman and chief executive vice president of Wegener Corporation, once a publicly traded company and 177th on the Inc. 500 list. Both companies manufacture satellite communications equipment. Heinz has also held engineering positions at Scientific Atlanta, Georgia Tech, General Electric, and Magnavox. Heinz and his family immigrated from Germany in 1951, and he's been married to his wife, Nan, for 58 years. In 1978, he founded Wegener Communications, which began in his laundry room but grew to become an international supplier of satellite communications equipment. But even founding a successful company didn't bring fulfillment until he invited Jesus Christ into his life as his Lord and Savior. Heinz spun off Cross Technologies, Inc. from Wegener in 1994 to have a private company that could witness boldly for Christ in the marketplace. He's co-hosted the Norcross Fellowship Luncheon with Larry Schrader from 1985 to 2022, now with Jeff Meyer as co-host, which meets every Wednesday. Heinz and Nan have two grown children and five grandchildren.
Yay.
Heinz,
great.
Please welcome our featured speaker.
Great.
Heinz Wegener.
Great. That's a tough act to follow there, Alan. Thank you. I'm Heinz Wegener, and meeting has been going on since 99, and it's to get to know people more. We've talked a lot about certain things, but when you're the main speaker, you can tell a lot of things from your early childhood and what you've learned and that kind of thing. Just a couple interesting fun facts here. By the way, if I had not had my faith experience, I would have been dead right now, and probably about 40 years ago, because I was on a fast track to nowhere. Very successful, but an alcoholic and workaholic, and anyway, so. But thanks for that. The NFL has been going for, it'll be 40 years this year, the Norcross Fellowship Luncheon. It was our 58th wedding anniversary, my 59th high school reunion. I got married 1 year after after I graduated from high school, 55th college year since I started college. My son is 53, and we've been living in Atlanta for 53 years. Nan, my wife, was 6 months pregnant for our first child when I made the move from Utica, New York, where I was working at that time. She was real happy about that, but anyway, we did survive that. So, and as I said, I'm 78 this year. Basically, I just want to give a general background and how some of the things that are important to me became important, and so that's the purpose of this little talk here. As I mentioned, I was born in Germany. I was 4 years old when we came over. My family immigrated, was able to immigrate because my mom was a refugee from East Germany, from Poland, which was had been Germany before World War I, and then became Poland. In fact, you can see pictures over there. I did was involved in a group called My Story, which is was a way to write your story for your kids and your grandkids. It wasn't intended to be a bestseller or anything, and I didn't get it finished all the way, but I did put some pictures together of some of the key parts of my life, and that's why I brought that little thing over here. So. We came over on a converted troop carrier, we were sponsored by a Mennonite lady called Minnie Miller. And today, Minnie Miller is a small beer, right? Raise your hand if you know that.
Oh, now I get it.
Oh, yeah. No, I thought somebody... Just keep going, okay?
You'll get it.
Yeah.
Humor,
keep going, I'm sorry. I did have a great childhood. My parents were hardworking. They didn't fight a lot. They didn't struggle with, things that people struggle with sometimes when they have too much money. And they just tried to make enough money to live on a day-by-day basis. And they of course, that gave me the opportunity to go to school here and be able to go to college. I did pretty good in my classes. I was, I think, the second guy grade-wise in my class of about 200. And getting grades was kind of a sport to me, trying to see if I could do good in that, like I tried to do in football and basketball and the other sports that I played at that time. I was as tall as I am now in sixth grade, so I was the man on the court when it came to basketball in sixth grade. And in fact, everybody was about a foot shorter than I was, and people used to yell at me and say I'd flunked five grades. And anyway, but I did well in school and was the first one to go to college in my family. My parents didn't have any money to help me with that, so I had to pay for my own education. Got a scholarship because of my grades, and went to Indiana Tech in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And that's not like Georgia Tech. They don't have a football team. They now have a soccer team, and they're still doing real well. In fact, they've grown very significantly since then. But got my BSEE and got married after my freshman year of college. I had dated my wife, Nan, for 3 years, and we got married after my freshman year in college. And so she helped me with my to pay for my college. And so graduated in 1970, went to work in Utica, New York with General Electric. I had worked part-time at a company called Magnavox in Fort Wayne, which was doing military work. They were doing receivers for Jeeps and stuff for the military, and I worked on that as a technician. I mean, I was not an engineer. And I thought I would just work there because Fort Wayne was 60 miles away from my hometown, Goshen, Indiana, and I'd never been far away from home, so working there would have been a really great. Well, Magnavox had their first layoff in the history of that division 6 months before I graduated, so they couldn't make me a job offer. And, as you look back on your life, you see these little hiccups along the way that put you into places you would have never dreamt of, that leapfrog you into places you never would dreamed of. And that's kind of what happened here. As a result of that, went to GE in Utica, New York, was involved in their advanced course for engineering program, which if I would have stayed there, would have gotten me a master's degree free at Syracuse University. But I got drafted after my first year, and I was going to join the, no, I didn't get drafted. I was going to get drafted, and one of the guys that worked with me, a draftsman, asked me, said, "Hines, what are you doing about the military?" This was the early 70s, Vietnam, and all that kind of stuff. And I said, "Well, I'll probably get drafted." And he said, "How would you like to go to the National Guard?" And I said, "Yeah, me and 10,000 other people." And he said, "I can get you in. This is Utica, New York." His name was Mike Mafia. But he never asked me for anything. But seriously, his name was Mike Mafia. And he got me in the National Guard, went to basic training at Fort Dix, advanced training at Aberdeen Proving Grounds. Some of you that maybe have some friends or know where those kind of things are. But and then got back to GE to do my regular work, and was really kind of going to stay there, except I was working on military programs, and nothing ever shipped on the military program. It was a constant development, which is good. I mean, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but I wanted to be in an environment that did ship equipment, like I had kind of experienced at Magnavox when I was there. So I sent out some resumes and had several job offers because of the good experience I had at GE, and had never been south of Indianapolis in my travels. And I got an offer at Scientific Atlanta. So I came down here. It was, I think, the end of April. Utica, New York still has 6 inches of snow on the ground.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm driving from the airport, Atlanta airport, to my hotel, and the leaves are on the trees already, and the birds are chirping, and I thought, this could be a good gig. So that, in addition to, this was in the very early days of Scientific Atlanta. They were about, at that time, a $10 million company, which wasn't real small at that time, but it was still, they grew to almost a billion-dollar company after I left. But anyway, so I went to work there and had a really good experience in the satellite communications division. I was an engineer that designed some of the circuitry there and loved it. Unfortunately, I was a workaholic and also an alcoholic. I drank too much but worked 80, 90 hours a week and loved doing that. What happened there is, this is another one of those glitches in the road that seemed tragic at the time, but I was working all the time, and our projects were just new products, and I just enjoyed them, and they were doing good. Well, Scientific Atlanta had a reduction in their sales, so they had to cut back some people, and so my boss, who became my business partner, after I left there, Bob Plasek, he was told to tell all his engineers to cut back on the consultants that were working for them. And I had a couple consultants working for me on some projects that were hourly, you know, contract people. And so I said, Bob, if I can just have these guys work 2 more weeks, that will transition this project and it'll really help get this product out. And I thought I had his approval. So I go back to work, and a couple of days later, the vice president of the of Scientific Atlanta, who now had taken over this department and mandated the cutback, called all the senior people into his office, and I was one of the senior people. And so we're sitting there, and I'm probably the youngest guy in there, and, you know, my boss and his boss and, you know, some real high-level guys there. And Howard, the VP, gets everybody in, closes the door, and he takes out a piece of paper and slams it on in front of me. And he says, Wegener, what is this? Well, it was the memo I'd written to my boss asking for the two consultants to stay 2 more weeks. And he said, didn't I tell you, you got to get rid of people? And he just ripped me apart because he saw it as a challenge to his authority. And I think this is also kind of how he managed it. We made up many years later, but at the time, it was tragic for me. And I barely could keep from crying in the meeting. Meeting was over. I went home and just cried for hours because that job that I loved so much and was such a part of me had just gotten deflated, and I'd lost my desire to work there. And so so finally went back to work and started looking for some other jobs on the side, and found a job at Georgia Tech at the experiment station, where I worked for a couple years, and that doing consulting for that led to starting my first company called Wegener. And if you look in the little booklet that I have, you should each have one of these in front of you like the Bible. No, but there's a picture of me in, this is my laundry room at 1629 Camelot Circle in Tucker. We had a house that was about 300 square feet, maybe a little bit. But and I started to do some work and got a contract for a audio and data multiplexer for the satellite business at that time, because the satellite distribution to cable was a big deal, but they were short on programming, so it was very expensive to send the main video. So somebody come, well, I think my partner, business partner Bob, at Scientific Atlanta, who became he became the president of Cross at Wegener Communications, so he had kind of gotten this thing started, and they needed something to put audio and video on one carrier instead of two carriers. Anyways, technical jargon, but I did a quote on it, got a contract for it, and Georgia Tech allowed me to cut back my work there and do more consulting as the consulting work grew. And as a result of that contract, I went to my basement and went full-time in my basement and mentioned this to Bob, who was my former boss at Scientific Atlanta, and he joined me without any money, without any guarantee of anything, but he saw this vision, and through his vision, we ended up getting the company, which had my name on it, called Wegener, up to a $30 million company, publicly held, 177th on the NASDAQ. And so it's just a dream come true as far as my career went. Also during that time, I had a kind of a personal moment of feeling empty. Here I'd had all this success and my company, my name was on the company that was going skyrocketing, and I was empty. And I'd gone to church all my life, 33 years at that time, but I had no connection with God. I had no relationship with Him. And a friend that met me there and saw kind of my emptiness, Clarence Burkholder, who was formerly a Mennonite, a guy growing up. I don't know whether any of you know Mennonites, but the Mennonites were the ones that sponsored my family to come to Indiana from Germany. Anyway, he invited me to this Bible study, which were actually instructions in the Catholic Church. My wife was Catholic. I'd grown up Lutheran. And the couple that led that were had become born-again believers. They'd accepted Christ and understood what that meant. And so they did an amazing job of ministering the gospel to me there. And in fact, it was another emotional time when I walked into the room that Clarence took me to. I sensed the presence of Jesus, even though I was lost as a goose in high weeds. Anybody ever been in high weeds? No? Okay, you don't have to admit it. And so that changed my life, and the peace that I was looking for came. And through that process, I wanted to be more bold in my faith in the marketplace, and so my partner, business partner Bob at Cross Technology, at Wegener, saw that was important. And so one day, out of the blue, he said, "Hines, you started this company," and at that time we were a $15, $20 million company, so it wasn't a garage shop anymore. He said, "You started this company, what would you like to get out of it?" And just as if I'd rehearsed this, but it just came out without me thinking of it, I said, "A small private company where I could share my faith and do engineering work again." And he said, "I think we can do that," and began a process of spinning off this little company of six people from Wegener, which was a public company, and going through all the technicalities of that. And 2 years had gone by, and nothing had happened. I mean, we'd been actively trying to do the spinoff, but the IRS or the NASDAQ or whatever just seemed to be dragging their feet. And I walked into the building one time, and now we had a 40,000 square foot building, had my name on it. In fact, it's still in Technology Park, Johns Creek. Wegener's been out of that building for about 10 years, but they haven't sold the building yet. So if you want to see the building, it's got Wegener Communications on it, and it looks pretty rough. But anyway, so I'm walking into this building with my name on it, and in my mind, I say, "You know, Lord, I really appreciate this little company that we're prototyping, that we prototyped this little group, and it's really been a blessing to me. And if the spinoff never happens, that's okay with me." Now, if any of you ever prayed that if that doesn't happen, it's okay with me prayer, and maybe you've had the same result. Anyway, so I walk into the beautiful spring day. I walk into the front of this big building and get into the lobby. My former secretary, Pat, walks down the hall. She was Bob's secretary as well. She said, "Hines, the IRS just called. They've approved the spinoff. We'd like to do it by Friday." So and within a week, I had spun off this little company, Cross Technologies, and it's been a blessing ever since. We've had some financial challenges. In fact, one of the things that I was adamant about is making it a debt-free company. And debt-free is a biblical principle that's not very much tried. And so we were doing okay in that and financing it with our business. And our business kind of tapered down. And all of a sudden, we were putting in our own personal money to keep the company going. We had, I don't know, maybe 8-10 people then. It wasn't a big company. But my wife and I agreed. By the way, that's the other thing that I think is important. If you're making any big decisions and you're married, you need to have your wife's approval. And even if, anyway, that's just something I'm a big believer in. So she's also vice president of, Gary, if you need the lead, go ahead. Yeah, I'm sorry. But she's also the vice president of finance, has always been, and at Wegener was, and so she handled all the money. I'm like Lucy and Goosey when it comes to money. Money? What's that? You know, who needs that? We were really getting down to putting our own money in there, and we're almost to the point where we didn't have any money left in our bank account. And so I ran it by Nan, and she said, if you really think this is what the Lord wants us to do, we'll put everything in. We'll put every nickel we have into this company and keep it going. And when we both made that decision, it was like a switch turned, and all of a sudden the business came, and it came back and came back. We ended up growing to, it's still a small company. I think we had most people we had is 19. And that's one of the things in my motive for this company. I didn't have any growth goals. I don't want to make things happen at the expense of people and expense of an environment that's awful to work in. But we ended up, also during this time, I felt like I wanted to be a shocking contrast to other companies. So I was kind of praying about that, and the thought occurred to me that my experience in the high-tech business has been 60, 70, 80-hour weeks are normal. And we were not working that much, but maybe 50. And so the idea of a 32-hour work week came to my mind, as I believe was a thing God had called me to do. And so I ran it by Nan, and she said, again, if that's what God's calling you to do. So I tried to phase it in over 2 years by doing efficiency improvements and then, 6 months and getting one Friday off, another 6 months, another. Well, the first 6 months went pretty good, but then the next 6 months bogged down and nothing, we weren't finding the efficiency improvements. So I was in prayer at one time and I felt like the Lord spoke to my heart and he said it was my idea, God's idea, to go to a 32-hour work week. It was your idea to phase it in over 2 years. So I went into work that morning. I said, we're going to 32 hours, no goals or objectives. This is what God's called me to do, and I'm going to do it. And it's worked great. And we have the 32-hour, had it for 22 years now. Our parking lot is empty Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And it's just amazing what we could have done in 4 days, 32 hours, in a very high-tech company. So anyway, so where am I going personally? Also in the Norcross Fellowship Luncheon, which is a platform for businessmen to share his faith. I started that as well. But I believe that retirement is not a biblical principle. And Moses didn't retire, and et cetera, et cetera. And I believe if we're doing something that's consistent with how God wired us, we're going to have joy in our effort, and it's not going to be a labor. It's going to be like playing golf, right? No, not quite. Okay, not quite. Not okay. That's going too far. Okay, but so anyway, I love what I do. I mentioned I'm 78, and I tell people I'm going to work till Jesus comes or I go, and then Nan will have to take care of it from there. But it's an enjoyable life, and one of the things I keep thinking of is one of the things that I think we take for granted sometime is the peace that comes with a personal relationship with Jesus. And we kind of get used to that. And, you know, I don't have anxiety. I mean, it's just not in me. And it's because of my faith in Christ. And so I think the part of being a witness is to be steady and stable and positive in a world that's not steady or stable or positive. And the weirder it gets, the more of a witness people are that can have that inner peace that comes, I believe, only from accepting Jesus as Lord and Savior. Plus, I know where I'm going. You know, I know when I breathe my last breath here, I'm going to be in heaven. And I also believe, and I think there's some scriptural basis to this, that somehow in heaven, we're not just going to be floating around like angels and Casper the Friendly Ghost, but we're going to be doing things like we've done here that God has wired us for. Now, for some of us, it may not be what we did here because we may have never plugged in with what God wired us for. But I think there are some cases, and I believe that I have pretty much plugged in with how God wired me, that we'll be doing similar things when we get to heaven. Now, I don't know how you sell things and do P&L statements and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But anyway, so that's just my thought. So I think that's pretty much it. Any questions? And okay. Yes. Yeah. Real loud.
So your family came from Europe. I would say your life exemplifies the concept of the American dream, right? Immigrants.
Yeah.
Settled here, worked their way up, you became successful. How do you feel called to, or have you felt called to repeat that cycle to help sustain that in the world?
That's a good question, and I really haven't been encouraging, for instance, other people from other countries to come over here. But that's a good word to be helpful with people. We do have friends, in Israel and people with that work on in different ministry capacities. But as far as doing a similar thing, having an opportunity starting from some place that you don't have any opportunities. I mean, that's just the way it was. It wasn't people being mad at you or anything. It was just that's the way the culture was. But that's a good question. Anything else?
You know, I don't know where Ron was going with that in his mind, but what I see, and I'm not trying to hijack your talk, is, as you guys know, I moved here in 85 here in Forsyth County, and the diversity was zero.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it's zero. There's zero diversity, and that's and that's just the way it was. But now the diversity is off the charts, and there's a lot of people that have moved here that could benefit from Heinz the store, because and what I'm saying is how to assimilate, how to live the American dream. There's a lot of my wife has just finished up being a kindergarten teacher for the last 3 or 4 years. That's not her career, but that's what she did the last 3 years. And it's like the United Nations in kindergarten in Forsyth County.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just
for any elementary school.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, and that she had to find somebody that could understand Turkish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for a kindergartner speaking Turkish, nobody can talk to them. So, and it's the same thing as Russian. It's Somalian. It's Latino. It's you know. I mean, it's all of the world. And these people are trying to live your dream. This is the land of milk and honey.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a great place to live. We know that. And how we could do a ministry to help them would be is something I've thought about. I don't know if that, again, that's where you're going. It's how do you help all these people that are coming here to live the Heinz story, because it's a true story and it's a reality for them. And and then also, you know, get them, expose them to Christianity.
Yeah, yeah.
If that, some are already Christians, don't get me wrong.
Absolutely, yeah.
So anyway, I'm sorry to hit on that something, and I don't know again how you were headed with that, but
yeah,
something like that. I know you would say, well, why can't we?
Well, and that's what the Mennonite people did. And remember, Germany Germans after World War II were pretty negatively considered, rightfully so, because there was some tragedy that that Germans did that are just unbelievable.
Were the Mennonites an offshoot of Protestantism?
Oh yeah. They're very basic. In fact, and then Amish are even more conservative than Mennonites are. You know, they're very low on using technology. Amish theoretically use no technology, and we had Amish neighbors. And one time we went to church in a horse and buggy with them. And but that's a great.
But the Mennonites go both. I don't want to say it's the wrong term. Go both ways. They don't just bring people here. They go and instead of send their families to Guatemala or Honduras and say, live here and establish our, something in
that's good, Jim.
For 2 or 3 years, come back too.
Yeah.
They do, it's not just bringing people refugees here. They also go and help them.
And we have a
pretty impressive faith.
We have a pretty big Indian community at our church that I think actually has a separate service. Yes, Gary.
Your family came from Germany. You were born in Germany. You came at age 4. So technically, you probably grew up almost as an American.
With
a little bit of German.
Yeah.
I'm a first generation American. My dad came from Trevino, Sicily. My mom came from Giessen, Germany. They left in depression and war. No education of any consequence. And they just needed to get out. America was a hope and a dream.
Yeah.
And I have a very strong sense that when someone comes to America, they have to learn the culture, the language. I have no problem. We still celebrate all the Italian and all the German culture in our family, but Americanism came first. And I really think a lot of the problems we have in America today is we lost the sense of immigrants that came here and they wanted to become American.
Mm-hmm.
Such a huge number that want to keep their cultural identity to the exclusion of Americanism. I'll give you an example. You can go to Japan and become a citizen. You're not going to be a Japanese. Mm-hmm. You can go to Germany and become a citizen. You're not going to become a German. You can go to Italy and you can become a citizen. You're not going to be Italian. But you come to the United States, you become an American. I don't care what color you are.
Yeah,
I don't care what your language is.
Yeah.
I don't care what continent you came from. And you can be as American as the President of the United States, all the way down to anything you want. And I do think that the Christian community could play a bigger role, because you go back, Henry Ford swore more people in as citizens of the United States than any other human being recorded. I don't know if y'all know
that. I never knew that.
And what he demanded was, you have 3 years to learn our language so well that you are American. And if you will do so, I'll give you your home, I'll put you to work, your kids will be in the best education, and you'll get paid a higher wage than all the competitors because you're going to be more qualified. And as a result, those people that went to Ford Motor Company, their children's children are still buying Ford Motor Company cars because there's a loyalty and a respect and an appreciation. Somehow, we need to get the Christian community to figure out how to get people who want to be here and live here become American. It's a distinct culture.
Yeah.
And that's this wide divide we're seeing today. And the school that your wife was teaching, my wife stopped teaching school early in her career. She couldn't do it because she was in South Texas. English was not spoken except among maybe 10% of the students and half the teachers. It destroyed the community, quite frankly.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it goes kind of to what...
And they don't get the quality of life. They don't get
they're missing out. They're missing out on these experiences.
They're missing out on everything.
And I think
the Christians have a role to play, and we don't do it very well.
The Christian community has dropped the ball.
Yeah.
They've maybe put effort to bring people here, but then they say,
and feed them and take care of them.
Let somebody else do the rest, and that's not right.
That's
I agree with you.
The Catholic
and that's
Church,
not any... That's Catholic, all Christian.
Yeah. In the Catholic Church... really, for a long time, probably held the leadership role when people came here, because it was the biggest population of Christians. And they really had the role. But then they had the cultural divide, Christians versus WASP, And so the Irish police and the Chicago and the Italian things, well, they were the gutter people, so to speak. And so the Catholicism was pretty strict, the Pope and so forth. The Protestant, there became this clash within even the Christian community. That seems to start to be going away now.
Yeah.
And I, by the way, I when the American Pope was selected, I thought, Jesus is coming.
Yeah, right, right.
I never saw that coming.
And I think, and we have to close here, but I think the thing that comes to mind is being encouraged with conversations like we've had here, and then doing a one-on-one. I haven't been intentional in reaching out to people like the Mennonites were intentional in reaching out to my family, you know, and the Amish too, and so that's a good word.
But again, I know you're in contrast, other faiths do. Yeah. Other faiths bring their people in. Islam is growing.
Yeah, yeah.
You may not know it's growing very fast here in Forsyth County.
Yeah.
But they take care of the people and they assimilate them, at least in their culture. In their area, the same with the Jewish community, and same with other faiths.
Yeah,
and good. I'm not saying we as you guys, I believe the Christian faith is not very organized in doing that.
Yeah, and I think that's a good word here for us to see how we can individually.
Yeah.
I think it starts with people doing one-on-one things that others observe, and then they pull to that. It's not like all of a sudden starting off this organization, which is not a bad thing. But anyway, let's close.
Jim made a comment. So we're not very organized. That's the key. We have pockets or certain churches, like, you know, that go out and evangelize and go for it all the way. But as a church culture,
right?
You know,
right.
You went to the church.
Almost going against each other.
Well, you went to the church of Jerusalem. You went to the church of Thessalonica or whatever. It was a unified group of Christian people. In the United States, and it's just the nature of human beings, we start to make our own little agendas and organizations, and then they become jealous of the territory. And we there are those who try to overcome that again. And I mean, there's room for some improvement.
Absolutely.
If we can figure out how to get rid of the pockets.
Right.
And go more as a congregation, I think we'd be more successful.
Good word, good word. Okay, let me close the meeting. Thank you for coming, and go ahead and get some more food there. Come on, how about a little more bacon?
Can I add one more thing?
Yes, sure, go ahead.
So last quarter we had a question. I mentioned that I was concerned that there might be neighbors in my street that were older gentlemen that were by themselves.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was worried that there might be these folks that are, you know, kind of in a condition of need occasionally.
Yeah.
So I did check in. It took me several visits to
awesome.
Check in on one guy down the street that was the one that was the main concern for me. And he's fine. He's got middle-level Parkinson's, but he said, yeah, when I need something, I call my nephew. So on the one hand, it's not something that's urgent, but I think there's still something there. And the fact that we're all here is probably a good piece of evidence in that direction too.
Terrific.
Sooner or later, some of us are going to outlive our spouses. I don't feel like that's me anytime soon, but it's something that strikes me as a circumstance that maybe we're, you know, all sooner or later going to, you know, half of us might find ourselves in.
Yep.
So if anyone has any ideas on how to turn this into some kind of an initiative or a branded thing or a program, I would love to spend energy talking about it. It's something that's like, maybe I've got 5 or 10% of the hours in my head to think about. But what I'm trying to figure out is, how do we make it acceptable?
Yeah.
How do we remove the stigma of it?
Yeah.
So that those of us who are able-bodied and have time, and my kids are out of the house. I got all the time in the world now, right?
Like, terrific.
I'm sure you've all been down that road. It's like when your kids go off to college, you know, suddenly the work level plummets, your cash goes way up. You know, it's like all of a sudden, you know, you find yourself in this happy space. But, you know, I mean,
not there yet.
10, 15, 20 years, you know, eventually you might find yourself, you know, in your later years alone. And I don't want these folks to be shut-ins. I don't want them to be somebody that can't change a light bulb or a battery on a smoke detector, because that's the kind of thing that happens and people fall and hurt themselves. So how do we create an outreach program or some sort of an engagement program to make it acceptable for people to pick up the phone and say, hey, I need help with just this one thing,
I think it starts like you're doing, and do you guys get the newsletter? You get the polo.
Yeah.
Well, there's information
you mentioned that last
there.
Time,
yeah.
And I didn't do it. So
yeah.
Because
I try to read it, and that's a great idea.
It's a free initiative.
Yeah, and you may be the guy. The other thing I would suggest is do a web search on it.
Yeah.
It's amazing what people have done.
Sure.
When you do some searches on specific things, and all of a sudden you find out that... Anyway, so we're going to close the meeting. Okay, thanks for coming, please pass the word along, and we'll have the next one in 3 months.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jim. Woo!